Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. Oh, we're going all boaty, Zach.
We are going boaty and we've left Chris out as well, which is sad.
That's because we both wanted this interview, so no offence. We did. And also as well, he's ginger and it's 35 odd degrees. I don't think he's even rolling off his... last I heard, he was lying naked and uncovered on his bed, like just shrieking in pain at the heat. So
I've heard he's just slathered himself with ice cream in a desperate attempt to get cool.
Yeah, that would not surprise me at all. So I'm pretty sure Chris was unavailable today anyway. Who have we got with us?
We have James Bartle, who's a PhD student from Plymouth. He's specialising in sea power and communications. And in the process of his work, he gets the rather fun job of interviewing veterans. Slightly jealous. There aren't many veterans from my period left anymore. James, welcome to History Hack. I gather we're going to talk women in the Royal Navy in World War II. So we're going sort of proper boaty, but a boaty bit that's ignored.
Yes, well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. And as you said, aren't I lucky to get to spend time with these veterans, remarkable women. And I think today we're going to talk a bit about the Women's Royal Naval Service during the Second World War, because when we think of the Royal Navy during the Second World War, we automatically think of ships at sea. I mean, you know, just a dumb thing, really. But we don't really think about how it's coordinated from the shore. And so my PhD is basically looking at these different shore commands around the United Kingdom during the Second World War, which basically protected home waters throughout the conflict.
So let's put this in a bit of context, because if you are a Royal Navy and World War II dunce like me, your knowledge basically consists of Hood, Bismarck,
Airfix models.
Airfix models. Don't forget the Airfix. Don't sit there and denigrate the Airfix models. I'm not having you do that.
Boss. Love an Airfix model.
see, you're outnumbered. Shut up.
I just bitter because I can't. There's always leftover bits. Always.
We should probably get back to history, though. Yeah. All right then. But I mean, if you are one of these dunces, then you know, this command structure doesn't kind of mean much to you. So how does the Royal Navy work when it comes to home waters? Who's doing what and where and all the rest of it?
Well, firstly, I don't blame you, because automatically when you think of the war at sea, it's the war at sea, isn't it? So we think of ships on the sea. We think of great sea battles. You mentioned Bismarck there, you know, the battle between the Hood and the Bismarck, King George V and all that sort of stuff. But actually, as part of my, you know, PhD, I'm trying to change this perception somewhat, because around the waters of the United Kingdom were a series of shore commands. And these shore commands, you know, these can be traced back to the days of Nelson. So, for example, like port admirals, residing admirals, they were responsible for sending reports off to the Admiralty. They were responsible for protecting shipping in a specific area. And this is what, you know, this is what naval commands are doing in the Second World War. These commands are responsible for, you know, protecting shipping, hunting down E-boats, operating mine sweeping functions, things like that. And they're dotted all around the coast. So off the top of my head, like, you know, you have ones in... You have a Dover one, you have a Portsmouth one, you have a Plymouth one, you have a Western Approaches Command, which is based up in Liverpool. And what is really interesting in terms of my research is that they're a joint service headquarters. So, you know, within these are mainly underground, these are like multi-story bunkers, you know, partially underground, partially not underground. And in the underground section, you would have a joint operations room with the Royal Navy, Air Force and Army all working together. And it is this joint inter-service cooperation that enables them to take part in the largest like operations in World War II. So, for example, the evacuation from Dunkirk is operated from Naval Command. The D-Day landings is operated from Plymouth Command. Protecting that invasion force is operated from Plymouth. And what is really remarkable, and something why I'm on this podcast, is that these commands were run by a predominantly female workforce from about 1941 onwards.
I love this. And there's a legacy of protection as well, isn't there? Because it stays even though warfare develops. So obviously the Navy protected Britain, but then aeroplanes come along in World War One, and like 1914 and 15, the logical step is to place the Navy in charge of defending Britain, isn't it? It moves in 16 over to the Army as the bigger service. But I mean, the initial reaction is to leave protecting Britain in the hands of the Navy. So these women have got a huge responsibility on their shoulders.
Absolutely. And you know what? Yeah. Talking to surviving veterans, they you know, that almost cliche line, they just got on with the job. They had a job to do and they just did the job. But my goodness, didn't they they did the job so well. Like, you know, protecting ships, it's not easy. As anybody has ever seen me trying to open up a tab on like Internet Explorer, I struggle with that. I struggle with logging in data. I struggle accessing my Twitter page, for heaven's sake. So if, you know, just picture the scene. So women in this like big command room. So you got maps on the walls, table maps in front of you, and a series of telephones around the side. So these telephones were connected to radar stations. They were connected all around the country. So they would get a phone call and they would say, like, ship A is in this position. And then they would have to plot ship A. And, you know, this is the 1940s here. If you make a mistake, there are going to be some serious dire consequences. And it's just a testament to these women that these mistakes are really infrequent, at least in my research. And again, we tend to focus on ships at sea, but where are the ships at sea getting their orders from? Where are they being told to go? Where how do they know that the convoy that they're going to escort is in this position? It's from headquarters on shore. And who's running the headquarters on shore? It's female service personnel.
This is brilliant. They had a super fan prior to 1939, and that was George V. Not in a pervy way, but he adored a girl in uniform. He thought it was magnificent that women had come out of the home. I mean, and he was quite an old-fashioned dude, but his wife was not. She was a feminist in her own way with her giant feather hats and her parasols. But, I mean, Queen Mary wore the trousers in that house. So he's used to strong women. And he, as a naval man, he adored the Wrens. He thought they looked so smart. He was so proud of Britain's women and girls coming forward and taking a part in the First World War. Because this is a new thing in 1939, isn't it? So just tell us a bit about how the Wrens comes into being.
It's certainly not a new thing in the Second World War. The Wrens were actually formed in 1917 in the midst of a manpower like crisis. The first Lord of the Admiralty, Sir Eric Geddes, wanted to free up men to send to sea. So the next logical step for him, you've got this great untapped resource of female service personnel that you can use. So he really kind of pushed the Wrens into coming into being. And similar as to what we'll see in the Second World War, women were drivers, women were telegraphists, women did all sorts of manner of jobs, and they did them well. However, unfortunately, as we will see later on with the end of the Second World War, after the war, we see this retraction into gender spheres. So in 1919, there was passed the Restoration of Pre-War Practices Act. This act is massive because it basically makes women not eligible to do the jobs that they have just been doing. They do this because they don't want to provide competition for men in the workplace. However, this is not the end of the Wrens. throughout the interwar period, they formed veterans formed the Association of the Wrens. They formed the magazine called The Wren. They hold different sorts of events, galas, things like that. These are all designed to give women voice and presence. And the Wrens, they don't go away. They constantly lobby for the service to be reformed. And then by 1939, with the combination of the international crisis with World War II looming, they actually happens, and the Wrens are reinstated. I must say, I'm nowhere near an expert on this subject. I would always direct somebody to go to the work of Hannah Roberts or Joe Stanley if they want to learn more about it. But it's such a fascinating story. I constantly find myself having to reread it because it's so interesting.
Shall we talk about that recruitment process then, when they decide that they do want Wrens, they do want women to fulfill certain roles? Because at one point they end up being so swamped they have to close recruitment, don't they? So talk us through kind of the types of women that end up in this service. I mean, there is this thing about, inverted commas, superior service and, supposed snobbishness. But, why are they swamped? Why Wrens as opposed to, the Women's Royal Air Force,
Well, you hit the nail on the head there with the whole kind of image of the superior service. And this is something that they didn't actually try to dissuade. But to return to that kind of point about the Wrens being socially exclusive, they were actually based on skills and abilities, as well as writing a letter saying that you wanted to join the Wrens. You would, for certain roles, you would have to provide, let's say you were applying to become a typist, you'd have to provide a certificate of typing speed, for example. But it's also so much more about character. When they were interviewing for, let's say, a coder, so you're dealing with really sensitive information. They wanted people who were quite quiet for the obvious reasons that they wouldn't divulge what they're doing. But it's a bit of an understatement to say the Wrens were popular. In 1939, when they opened it up, they had 3,000 vacancies. Does anybody want to guess how many people actually applied?
30,000.
I'm going to say double. This is for bragging rights within History Hack.
Lot on the line. It was actually 15,000, so I don't know who gets the bragging rights there.
I'm going to say I'm closer.
I mean, you can, but who's in charge?
This is a window into the kind of thing I have to put up with, listeners. Yeah. Pity me.
I'm just better. Just in the spirit of these women, I say no, I win, move on.
But thinking about it, from my limited perspective, you can see why women would want to join. But from 1941, you could join the Wrens from 17 years old with a letter from your parents. But many young women, this is their first opportunity to leave the home, to mix with new people, to experience new things, forge friendships, etc. This is such an exciting opportunity for people. But the amount of applicants for the Wrens was quite crazy. But by 1943, they had to close the close applicants for about 6 months because they were just getting so many applications. 1942, the Ministry of Labour said that you had to have a family member in the Royal Navy to actually be in the Wrens. So, it's so high demand.
See, I really like this because Nanny White was a Wren.
Yay!
Hooray for...
Look at his face. He's just all of a sudden, it's like, can I touch you?
Oh.
I never met Nanny White. She died in 1959. So,
oh wow, that's really young.
Yeah, but yeah, she did the whole uniform thing. We don't have many photos from that period, but she was kind of one of these Navy families. In fact, Granddad White was that they both had parents who died in the Merchant Naval Service, and they went to the same boarding school for for kids who'd lost a parent in the service. And that's how they met, you know, that one was head boy, the other was head girl, and then shenanigans happened over the course of the war.
Now we have a little Napoleonic nerd.
Now you have a little Napoleonic nerd. But interestingly, Granddad bucked the family trend and he went to the Air Force. So Nanny White was kind of sticking to the family tradition much more. And the others in the family did the same thing, actually. So her siblings went into actual, not Merchant Navy, but Royal Navy. So this feels kind of quite close to home. And it's interesting to kind of hear that if you had somebody in your family who was Navy, you kind of wanted to stay in Navy, and that kind of tendency. Why was that? Why was there this kind of focus on family connection?
Well, I suppose it's looking for the right sort of person, the kind of character, the grounding, you know, the sense of discipline, that knowing when to speak and when to not speak. These are a sense of duty. These are, again, it's kind of, you, we're kind of trying to fight this kind of image of the rents. Of course, it is socially exclusive because, you know, these will be daughters of admirals, for example, but it is those ingrained characteristics that they're looking for, and also suitable experience. So, you know, if you, let's say, using typing, if you didn't have a certificate of typing speed and you've just done some work experience, because let's remember also, like, you can, I think from 1941 onwards, you could join the Wrens for like from like 17, as long as you had a letter from a parent saying, you know, you're good to go. But yeah, like, as long as you had, like, let's say, some work experience of typing, they'll take you on. And they really did pride themselves. And again, it's building this image up as a superior service. And I'm biased because I love the Royal Navy. So definitely the superior service.
Yeah, let me just clear up that Nanny White was not the daughter of an admiral. That's not where where all of this comes from. You've looked very closely at Plymouth in particular. Give us some examples of the people, you know, the personal stories there. What are they doing? You've touched already on one individual who kind of gets the recognition. But give us some others to just kind of put some not exactly faces to the thing, but, you know, kind of some examples to flesh this out.
Now, rather awkwardly, considering what we just talked about, quite a few of the people I've interviewed were daughters of admirals, and other naval officers. But there's this lady that I interviewed that I absolutely love. She's 90. Bearing in mind, she must be 100 now, because I interviewed her when she was 99. Bearing in mind, 99 years old, she's still running a language school. And when I tried to organise a meeting with her, she said, yeah, can we do it a little bit later? As I'm manning the phones at the minute, so I'm the only one in the office, and I'm manning the phones. So these women are really indomitable. But that particular lady, yeah, her father was a naval officer, but she'd actually grown up with her family being part of the Brethren. I don't know if you've heard of that, but that is a very strict kind of religious orthodoxy. Like, you know, she didn't have to, for example, it was a very bare existence. I do encourage anybody to kind of look that up. But she actually made it to become a boat's crew. Now, in the Wrens during the war, becoming boat's crew was literally the pinnacle, because you get to go out and bring in these big old ships. Like, they would pilot them in, so you would see you would have these kind of grizzled old like sea dogs and seafarers on board their ship thinking, all right, so how are we going to get into port? Then up over the side rail would come this, you know, 17 year 18 year old wren saying, I can take you in. So like, you really do get a spirit of these people. And she made me laugh, actually, because she was in Plymouth at the time of the when the D-Day convoys set off, and she was in charge of giving out the sailing orders for the convoys. And she said to me rather glibly, I must have done something right, yeah, as they all left. So I thought that was just brilliant, because being able to maintain that sense of humour and also playing her part in the biggest maritime operation in history, it's really quite something.
So you look at Plymouth, but how Britain obviously still at that point is a worldwide empire. That's a lot of water and a lot.
It is a lot of water.
Yeah. So are there equivalent efforts to get women into the Royal Navy, into Royal Naval roles or Wren roles elsewhere in the empire?
Yeah, absolutely. That slightly later than in Britain, but there was definitely that kind of drive to, you know, get women involved in the Navy, like in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, Wren organisations were formed, albeit with a slightly different name because they come from those countries. But yeah, they undertook similar types of jobs. They to Leffenis, really kind of taking up the slack, because the catalyst for women's involvement in a kind of naval role was 1941, because the Admiralty made the decision that for positions that didn't require sea experience or physical strength on shore, women would literally take all the roles of that. And then later on in the year, we have the the Second National Service Act, which made women have to register I can't think of the exact name, but like at an employment centre. So yeah, but sadly, women across the world is something that hasn't been covered that much, and it's something that I am looking to kind of gain some more information on, because, you know, it's all well and me and good talking about Plymouth, and I do have examples from other places, but you do kind of need that wider perspective. But if I can trouble you with just one story about a group of wrens up in Liverpool. Now, Liverpool was the kind of head of the naval command system called Western Approaches. It was basically in charge of all shipping coming across the Atlantic, and being part of the Atlantic, it had to deal with the U-boat threat. So they had this training center called the Western Approaches Tactical Unit. Now, this was operated by a team of wrens. So what would happen is you'd get an experienced captain in to learn about the latest, you know, U-boat tactic. And, you know, he turns up in his gold braid and his hat and, you know, his nicely coiffed hair. And he would take part in these exercises. So what they would do, they would have a U-boat versus a ship, for example, and, you know, the U-boat had to kind of evade the U-boat, and, you know, these captains would take part in this exercise, and there's somebody behind the screen operating the part of the U-boat, and they keep getting sunk, you know, officers that have been in the Navy 10 or 15 years, they keep getting sunk, so, you know, they're very, like, so who is this sinking me? And then, you know, out from behind the curtain, Wizard of Oz style, comes these wrens who have literally just sunk an experienced captain of 20 or so years. And these tactics were really important in the Battle of the Atlantic. There's a great book by Simon Parkin called A Game of Birds and Wolves that looks into it. So I'll definitely encourage anybody interested to read that one as well.
I love this idea that they've just had their asses handed to them by a bunch of girls. You can imagine the conversation. Oh, well, it's really dreadfully unfair. Yeah,
it would be like Uncle Albert, wouldn't it? Like, oh, yeah, there were 20 of them. Big blokes, 20 big blokes. It was not an 18-year-old girl.
Yeah. That's made me giggle.
I mean,
I gave the book to my dad to read the other day, and he loved it. Absolutely, that was almost his favorite part of it. So that was good.
let's stay with that kind of stigma attitude. Is there stigma? I mean, this is the 1940s. This is not an era where, you can kind of call people out for the misogyny and all the rest of it. Do we have any evidence of that kind of thing?
Yes, we do have like a few prominent examples of this. Women, as the war progressed, women were sent overseas to kind of I keep wanting to say man, but it should be a different word, operate overseas facilities. And actually, a commander in chief actually prevented a sailing of these wrens over because they didn't think that they would be able to cope, and a war zone was no place for a woman. And actually, by the end of it, he did come into contact with wrens as part of his commu as part of the communication, he actually admitted, "No, I was wrong." And this is a common theme, I would say, for like women through their actions, proving themselves as good as men. And and I just wish that was kind of reflected in how they were kind of treated post-war, because we might come on to this, but there is just definitely a contracting of those gender spheres again, as what happened with the First World War.
They clearly never met Alex. I mean, you have one
Yeah.
conversation with Alex, and you have to stick in the idea that a woman can't hack it in a
That's
hostile
an
environment.
encounter I would love to
Great,
see.
isn't
You
it?
can stick your gold braid up. Yeah.
Yeah, bring it. Bring it. You're talking about contraction of gender spheres after the war. Is it like World War One? Is it like a disappointing return to? I mean, you've mentioned one woman who just seized a different avenue to go and be amazing in, but is it disappointing for these women after the war?
It's a little, like all things kind of history, it's a bit nuanced. The Royal Navy the Royal Navy kind of reluctantly kept the wrens going because other services, other auxiliary services were keeping them going. But you see a contraction of I'm just trying to get the number up here, of something like 120 categories and roles that wrens were doing during the war, cut down to about 55. And you wouldn't see, and women could not apply for those. I've got the number here. Yeah, 129 categories in the war were cut back to 55 post 1945. Iconic roles such as spokescrew with the standard, and almost all the technical jobs, really. And the women would not be able to apply for these roles until 1990. So it's a fair long way. In wider society, you still had prejudice. You had the marriage bar in the civil service, but I would say there is a definite improvement from after the First World War, mainly self-confidence, really. Again, I talk about this one of the people I interviewed, being 99 and still running a language school. Like, another one I interviewed is 101 and has just like brought out a book. So it did give self-confidence. Women could go to universities with grants, subjects such as aesthetics. And there is a school of thought that the kind of movement that happened in the 60s, the kind of move to breaking these kind of traditional, what a woman should be doing, actually led from, the women of the 1940s, because they're very much the mothers of the children of the 60s and moving forward. So it's kind of maybe a story of like personal empowerment rather than actual tangible changes in the fabric of a society, really.
So, just to kind of sum it up then, wrens in the Royal Navy and the Navy's success in the Second World War, how key would you say they are?
Well, I feel honour bound because this is the subject of my PhD to say. I would say, because my PhD is about shore commands, I would say absolutely vital. And it sounds a bit glib, but I am finding, as the wonderful process of research, as I'm going through my research, I'm just finding out how more and more important these women are. And I keep coming back to the D-Day landings, because it's the D-Day landings. Like, it's the reinvasion of Europe. And, without the women coordinating these different, like, ship movements, delivering sailing orders, it's the logistics that make it important. Like, you know, even today, like, loading up Zoom, or, like, this takes time. This takes somebody to do it, you know? And without them, you know, it would be, yeah, without them, I won't say Europe looks I won't say Europe looks different today, but they certainly play their role in how Europe looks right now.
James, it's a really nice point on which to end. Thank you for this. You are on Twitter if people want to find out more about your work, aren't you? Tell us where they can find you.
Yeah, you can find me at James Bartle #4. It's got a picture of me in front of the sea, appropriately. So, if anybody has trouble finding me. And can I just say thank you so much for inviting me on there. I've been looking forward to this. So it's been a lot of fun, and thank you for looking after me.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.